Is it possible to discover instantaneously what network services have been made available, even on massive networks? Is it possible to send a single packet to multiple recipients using today's multicast free internet? I don't know if you guys have noticed, but pretty much the condition of the internet is not going anywhere. IP multicast failed ages ago. IPv6 isn't going anywhere. IPsec, it's working for a few small deployments, but it's never going to reach global deployment either. Thank the failure certificates for that. So given what we've got, what can we do? NAT's been one of those solutions to, we don't have enough address space, or it's too much work to get new address space, or it's too much work to completely readdress every time we need another five IPs. NAT basically goes ahead and says, well, we'll have this small little range of globally addressable IPs, and we'll deal with it on our own side. And we'll do a bunch of translation. Are there other ways of doing that? Is it possible to share a globally addressable IP address without translating private IP ranges, like NAT does? Can we have some other approach? Is it possible to allow incoming connections to an IP address that's been NATed or has some kind of similar approach? NAT has this very strange aspect. People are very happy with it at first because finally they don't have to worry about some very, you know, hard-to-write firewall implementation that actually manages to block every single possible stream of data into their machine because they don't have a globally routable IP address. Only a very small subset of IP packets can actually get through through an adding firewall on the incoming side. Now, this is really cool until you want to actually do some kind of incoming connectivity. Then it becomes a royal mess to manage. And I've done a bunch of work, and of course, we're going to deal with that today now, aren't we? Finally, NAT deadlock resolution. Is it possible to establish a TCP connection between two hosts, both behind NATs? Yeah, it's possible. Gotta use a strategy I call restraint-free engineering. Abandon all practicality. These aren't necessarily good ideas. They're fun. They're useful. They might not be secure, but that's not what I'm looking at here. I just want to see what's possible. You guys can try to break it and, you know, have all your fun, but let's see what capabilities exist between the cracks, not to take things down, but to bring things up, to actually link together hosts that want to talk to each other. That's why we build networks. We don't build networks just to blow them up. This isn't Demolition Derby. Although Demolition Derby can be a hell of a lot of fun, too. I'm not ragging on you guys. So this might end up practical, it might end up secure, but right now these are impossible problems. Let's see if we can fix them. I know, it's not a talk on TCP/IP unless you talk about the three-way handshake. For those of you who are really familiar with it, just don't worry, it'll be over soon. Three-way handshake starts with a SYN. This is the connection request. This is, I want to talk to you. Now, to the response to this, you either get a SYNAC, oh, all right, let's talk, or a reset ACK, go away. And to that, you have a final packet that says, oh, hey, that's great, we're going to start talking, you know, ACK. Okay, let's begin our conversation. There is a little more. You have ports involved. Ports are basically a way of referring to what application made the request. So, you know, is it your web browser on your machine? Is it your Telnet client on your machine? That's your local port. Remote port refers to what's listening, you know, web. Do you want the web server here? Do you want the IMAP mail server here? Do you want the SSL secure web traffic? IP addresses handle who you want to talk to, or at least handle a pathway that will eventually get you to there. Phone number. Now, let me explain this difference. Phone numbers. Phone numbers are addresses. They don't necessarily map to locations. They don't necessarily map to individuals. What phone numbers do is they give you a pathway that hopefully will get you there. That's about all they do. You might call a business, and you might have to put in an extension, and you don't know where the desk is, and you don't actually know for sure that the right person is sitting at that desk. You don't know if there's been a transfer, and you sure as hell don't know if there's a hacker that's moved phones around. But you have a number, and you call it, and hopefully you get there. It's that way with phone numbers. It's that way with IP addresses as well. That's what IP does. Phone ports deal with what you actually are talking to once you get there. There is another thing. which is sequence numbers. Sequence numbers basically let you differentiate one connection from another. Now, local ports do this too, because every time you make a connection to a telnet server or a web server or whatnot, your operating system provides you with a different local port each time. It's a randomly generated number. But even if you know that, there's another sequence. There's another number, this sequence number, 32-bit long, random number. There's been some really interesting work done on breaking how random it is. But the idea is, if you want to participate in that three-way handshake, I'm going to give you this request, and it's going to have the sequence number. You need to give me back an acknowledge, either a SYNAC or a RESET ACK that matches that request number, that sequence number, plus one. Sequence numbers were specifically used beyond their original design intent for something called SYN cookies. They were developed in about 1996 when SYN floods finally started to become a reality. People realize, you know, there's this theoretical risk. Someone could just flood us with a bunch of requests, and I'm a kernel, I have some web server, I'm keeping track of everybody I've sent these, okay, you know, let's talk, the SYNACs too. But the SYNACs would be going to nowhere. They'd be, you know, going to some spoofed address. And what would happen is, you know, hosts could be dropped on a dime. The solution was SYN cookies. The idea is this. You've got a 32-bit number here. It's supposed to be random, but let's not generate it randomly. Instead, let's encode everything that the server is supposed to remember about this connection request that came into it. So the SYN comes in, and the server goes, great, here's a SYNAC. And I'm going to give you a little cookie, a little bit of information describing, you know, you came from here, you know, I actually have spoken to you before, and by the way, here's an MSS number, maximum segment size, just some bookkeeping information. It's the bookkeeping information that the kernel needs to be able to start a session after the final ACK comes back. After the final, great, you know, I've got your SYNAC, let's talk. All that information got thrown into the SYNAC's sequence number. The idea was illegitimate hosts would not return an ACK, and you could forget about them, just like you wanted to. Legitimate hosts, however, would give you an ACK back that had this little cookie. You cryptographically verify the cookie, see, yeah, no, this guy actually did have a session started with me. And then the kernel would do all this big, heavy lifting to actually start up a TCP session. SYNACs were a good hack. As far as I can tell, they're by DJ Bernstein, and he always makes good hacks. And we have some other reflections, too. The ACK reflects the sequence number in the SYNAC. But, you know, the SYNAC reflects the sequence number from the SYN. I wonder if we can do something with that. Stateless pulse scanning. Is it possible to discover what the heck's out there really, really fast? And the answer's yeah. And not only yeah, but you can do it fast, securely, and today, because the code's actually done. Two processes, scanner and listener processes. They're completely disconnected. There's a fork in the middle of the code, and just they have no idea about each other. One process sends out a bunch of SYN packets, huge number of requests. Forgets about it. They all have the same local port. Receiving side. Well, it tells the kernel using a libpcap interface, hey, give me all packets that are responding to that local port that that other process was using. Well, the packets that come back are either going to be SYNAC, meaning the port was up, or RESET ACK, meaning the port was down, but the host was up. Now, of course, there's that third possibility, which was, you know, this host doesn't exist. There is no IP at this machine. That's not what I'm dealing with. I want to see what actually exists, not what doesn't. Spoofed responses. You know, it's really easy to spoof. If my scanner isn't keeping track of who it sent requests to, then somebody can be like, hey, I'm getting hit with scans. I'm going to forge a huge number of responses. This guy's not keeping track of who he scanned. So I can make him think that 100,000 machines just popped up. He only scanned 256. I'm going to send him 100,000 responses just to screw with him. Not only do I flood him, but I probably crash whatever database he's throwing this information to. If nothing else, have some fun. Solution. Well, we've got those SYN cookies there, you know? Instead of tracking the SYNAC reflections in the ACK, let's track SYN reflections in the SYNAC. In other words, let's throw a cryptographic signature saying, not only here's a request, But hi, I'm a scanner and I scanned you. When you send your response saying that your port's up, give me this cryptographic little note here. When I get your response back, I'll look at the cryptographic little note, and if it looks good, I'm going to assign you as being up. This is basically tweaking SYN cookies to the exact opposite side. SYN cookies were developed to fight people who were doing floods of scans. This is using SYN cookies to make floods of scans better. And it's actually pretty nice. ScanRAND 1.0. That's what I've named the initial implementation of this. It's part of what I'm calling the Paketo Kairetsu, the packet system, a collection of code that basically does new things using raw packets. And by the way, Mike Schiffman, pimp for writing LibNet, whoever wrote libpcap, I bow to you too. All this has been done with really, really trivial C LibNet code and libpcap. 384 lines, so that's a little bit smaller than nmap. No state stored. We send SYN packets fast. We send them at about, with the MD4 cryptographic signature, it's a hash, but don't worry about it. It scans at about 11 to 20 megabit. These are 54-byte packets, by the way, so that's pretty damn fast. The code's probably even portable to any platform you throw it on. Here's a screenshot of it in action. I don't know if you can see it, but I've included time deltas. I'd scan my network at home. And I scanned 10.0.1.1 to 10.0.1.50. So about 50 hosts, scanned 400 ports a host. It's about 20,000 ports. We're getting responses between, at the 0.8 second mark up to the 5.6 second mark. I run this on much larger networks. I ran this on an unnamed massive corporate network against a Class B, 65,000 hosts searching for web servers. Told them in about 4 seconds they had 8,235 hosts. That works. Okay. What's nice is you actually get the ability to say, this is what's up now. If you ran nmap against the same set. Now, Fyodor's a god. Fyodor's awesome. Nmap is not fast for scanning a Class B when it comes to, I have this many hosts, you're going to wait a couple hours because it's going to ping things, it's going to look around. Nmap's not that fast for doing this. It is reliable, which my thing particularly isn't. But there's one cool little thing. You might be wondering, Dan, you've got all these packets going out, right? So what about collisions? What if you do your scan and packet starts colliding and you just drop packets in your scan? Well, on the SYNs, yes. If a SYN packet gets dropped, we're screwed. Oh well, do your scan twice to be sure. But if the SYN ACK is dropped, you see, a SYN ACK to a host deserves either an ACK or a reset ACK. Reset ACK says, or a reset. Reset say, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know why you sent me this packet, but whatever connection you've got, get rid of it because I'm not dealing with it. If a host responds with a SYN ACK and that SYN ACK is not responded to because it goes a collision, that host is going to send another one in a little while. And another, and another, and eventually it'll give up. So you actually have a little bit of resilience in a stateless scan, because the other guy's keeping state saying, I'm supposed to keep SYN-ACKing this guy. Something must have gone wrong. So that works pretty nicely. Observed results, they have about 8,300 servers. What I just said. Your kernel's actually providing the resets, because all these SYNs are being sent out from user space. Kernel has no idea. So kernel goes ahead and gets this SYN ACK and is just lost. FreeBSD actually will just be like, I'm sending out 300 to 500 or maybe 1,000 resets a second. I might be getting flooded. I think I'll slow down. There's probably some IOCTL to shut that down. Implications? We can do good things in user space. User space manipulation of packets can lead to less overhead. Yeah, that makes sense. Kernels are optimized to talk to other kernels. They're big old stack. I'm 384 lines of libnet and libpcap. What the hell do I have to do? Packet content can be overloaded. Anytime you see a random field, anytime, you can go ahead and replace that with encrypted data or with some signed information. Because if you don't have the key or you don't have the necessary cryptographic material, it's random. That's what the definition of cryptography does. It converts meaningful information to randomness to those who lack the key. Now, this is the heart of something really cool called cryptography. I'm going to go off for a second. Cryptography is using cryptography against cryptography. It's where you go ahead and you have some element of a crypto system that's supposed to be random. But, oh, in fact, that's your private key encrypted. You can't detect this on the network because the network is supposed to say, hey, that looks random. If it's random off of a radioactivity detector, if it's random off a noisy diode in the Pentium 3, if it's random because it's been encrypted by a Trojan horse, well, it's still random. You can't differentiate it. So cryptography is kind of cool, and I'm sort of using a tweak on it now. This is an elegant solution. I took an elegant solution to the SYN flooding problem, and I sort of repurposed it. So when you're doing things, you know, look for what you can repurpose, because sometimes you actually get some cool stuff. Now, this is the simplest of the stuff I've worked on. Now it starts getting fun. Packet structure. How many people here have messed around with a sniffer? Ethereal, particularly? There we go. That's my crowd here. All right. If you knew nothing about networks, you look at a packet structure and you're just like, what the hell is this? Starts off, next machine is supposed to go to, but this is where it came from, but this is the protocol you're supposed to go to, and here's another protocol, and now let's do a checksum. First hop, last hop, first app, last app, checksum, and then all this random data, what the hell? Couldn't it at least be ordered? Couldn't you, have your next hop, and, then your next hop, and then your last hop, and then your, last app? Couldn't it be, sorted in some kind of way that made a bit more sense? First reaction should probably have, but this is, who cares? Seriously, who gives a damn? And that's the point. Layers are not about what they say. Layers are about who cares what's being said. It's one medium. You have this one package of data that has many messages to many different participants. Listeners reconstruct those meanings that are relevant to them. They pull out what's relevant to them from the beginning of a packet, and then hopefully can ignore the rest. On layer two, here's the next machine is supposed to go to, or here's who sent it, here's where it's supposed to go to. The switch looks at it. Okay, I'm supposed to send all future data that way. Doesn't need to understand SNMP, doesn't need to understand HTTP, doesn't need to understand anything. Here's some information I care about, and here's a blob. And that's it. Messages at one layer can modulate messages received at another. I like to bring up the example of the Postal Service. Postal Service, by the way, doesn't care what you write in your letters. Ideally, they don't have to read them. Now, given certain political realities, this might shift. But ideally, the Postal Service looks at a little bit of address information on the outside of your letter, and that's where they send it. And they don't care. They just care about the weight, equivalent, total number of bytes. They just care about the weight of your letter and get it there. And this makes the Postal Service able to operate a lot more efficiently. Insufficient postage. Now you can do, everybody knows about the tricks with insufficient postage. You don't put enough postage on a letter. You set the return address on the letter to who you wanted to mail to. And hey, look, you get a free letter sent because they're going to send it back because that's a service that the Postal Service provides. They actually charge you for this by taking forever. And that's a really good idea. That's a very, very good idea. God. Can you imagine if you got junk mail sent like that? Business return mail. That guy's out. All right. Duties at each layer. Layer one's just the medium. Next atom I have to send this sequence to. We don't worry about that too much. Layer two, the next hop. Physically, the guy at the other end of the wire that I'm physically connected to, or in the wireless region, physically the person who's hearing what I have to say. At layer two, the state is destroyed with each frame. The layer two information is constantly being rewritten, constantly being destroyed. Nothing is kept the same. At layer four, which is TCP, I'm skipping layer three intentionally, don't worry, I can count. At layer four, TCP, the idea is your message isn't changed at all. I say ABC123, whatever happens in the middle, at the end, ABC123. Now, layer 3 is interesting. Layer 3 ends up being implemented by IP. Layer 3 is modulated. At minimum, the time to live is decremented, meaning for each hop that this thing travels, it's going to go down by one. So your packet gets changed a little. But some things remain the same. For example, the destination ideally remains the same. The source often doesn't. That's what happens in NAT. The source address goes from some local source that is going to hit the net, and no one's going to know how to send you back a packet, to whatever the firewall is using. The firewall is basically saying, look, you know, if you try to route to the 10 dot, you're not going to get there. So route to me, and I'll handle the rest. And that's what IP is all about. IP is all about get me closer. Not necessarily get me there. Remember, phone numbers aren't necessarily about get me there. It's get me closer. Every single router looks at the packet and says, this is supposed to go there. Where's the next closest physical address? And then it goes from one physical address to the next physical address to the next physical address, each time the frame information getting destroyed and reconstructed. Finally, you have a layer 5, a session, a crypto session often. All that open SSH work. Yeah, that went there. Little more information. Layer 2. Let's talk about error recovery. This is a really good way to... Trust me, this is relevant to understanding how packets work and how to screw with them. Layer 2. Errors are really quickly recoverable. It's because the guy who sent you an errored packet, oh, he's right there. He's right next to you. At some point, you have a physical connection to him. Unfortunately, error generation can happen at the same level. Anyone ever heard the example of how fertilizer gets, usually it starts below fertilizer. But, you know, it starts off low and it's fertilizer and then gets to, like, middle management and it's, farming supplies and finally it gets all the way to the CEO and, now it's stuff that makes life happen. And it started out crap, okay? That's what happens when you have no end-to-end error handling. Because what happens is everybody's adding a little bit of error. And internal to each of those point-to-point links, oh, did you say fertilizer? Yeah, I said fertilizer. Okay, I'm going to change it to whatever. Oh, did you say whatever? Yeah, I said whatever. And that's how it goes all the way on. And point-to-point, there's no error as it gets from below fertilizer to the stuff of life. However, that's not the message that was actually attempted to be sent. Error handling a little bit higher. You look at layer 3, router to router. So you've got all these possible sources of where the error could happen. You know, I send a ping, it's going to go through about 12 hosts, most likely. So that's 12 places where there might have been an error. If I'm going to negotiate with another router, I've got to negotiate with all those 12, and I don't give a crap. This information doesn't have any meaning to me as a router. I'm just trying to move data. In fact, the only modulation I usually do is decrement the TTL, and when I have a checksum in there, I don't actually recompute the checksum after the TTL is decremented. I say, you know, every time I decrement the TTL on a valid packet, it has this change to the checksum. So I'm just going to do this change to the checksum. That's it. Not actually checksumming the packet. If the original checksum was bad, oh, it'll just, you know, keep forwarding that along. But it'll take a bad checksum and modify it with the decrementing TTL. Why can it do that? Because the host that actually cares, layer 4 at TCP, this host has lots and lots of machines in between them. But it's really relevant data to him. If something goes wrong, his software is going to crash. If something goes wrong, his network connection went wrong. At some core definition, the definition of a network introducing error is when I send a message to you and you don't hear the same thing that I sent. And then layer 5 has a little bit of a modification when you add crypto systems. You actually have, it's not just checksums. You're not just looking for error. You're actually looking for protections against malicious attackers. And then we don't need to go too in-depth about that. Now, there's redundancy between layers. For example, broadcast. The idea of broadcast is everybody in some certain domain should get this message, not just one person. At layer 2, you have a broadcast address of all Fs. No matter the network, broadcast address of all Fs. If something's delivered to all Fs, it gets everywhere. Turns out, if this thing called IGMP snooping is disabled, the same is for a multicast MAC address. There's a certain prefix, I don't remember it off the top of my head, to multicast MAC addresses, and without IGMP enabled, you send something to a multicast MAC address from, you know, whatever the data is. All machines on that subnet are going to receive that data. This gets useful. Layer 3 has broadcast functionality too, and the broadcast IP address. Subnets. The concept of a subnet is, this is the region of IPs that is physically near me. This is the region of IPs that I should try to make direct connections to instead of going through a gateway. That's all a subnet is. It's, well, here's my neighbors. The last IP of the subnet is reserved for broadcast. It's relative. You know, one network has a different broadcast IP than another network has a different broadcast IP than another network. You can send to it most, a lot of firewalls block it. Because you, I don't know if anyone remembers the Smurf attacks from what, 97, 98. You go ahead and you'd send a ping to a directed broadcast address, and all those hosts would respond, and you know, it was a great way to do DOSes and whatnot. Ever. Yeah, so directed broadcast is pretty much suppressed as often as possible. However, there's this fun little thing you could do. I call it Guerrilla Multicast. Guerrilla Multicast. Is it possible? Send a single packet. I just want to send one packet, but I want lots and lots of people to get it. Or at least I just want more than one person to receive this packet that I sent. And I don't want this person to do a retransmission, because what if this person goes away? What if this person shuts down? P2P network authors. I mean, the network is supposed to deal with getting data from one point to another. I shouldn't have to deal with endpoints to do my multiplication. Can I use the network? I send one packet, multiple people get it. The answer is yeah. Yeah, you can. It gets a little ugly. You link a unicast IP. So, you know, 10.0.5.2. You take that IP, but its MAC address is broadcast. That's what its source host is. So when replies come back to it, guess where they're going to go? They're going to go to broadcast. Everybody's going to hear it. Now, you can't always do this with broadcast. Sometimes you have to do this with multicast if you like have a PIX firewall doing your NATing, because PIX doesn't like its ARP table having all Fs in it. I wonder why. The nice thing here, no individual client actually needs to keep listening. Like, any client can go away and broadcast is still broadcast, because the multiplexing, it's happening at the switch. The switch is splitting your stream for you. There might be demultiplexing, whatever. Summoning, here's how you do it. First of all, you DHCP for an IP. Now you can just grab one, but you know, let's you know still stay within the way most networks work. You grab an IP and you reserve it. Now this IP isn't actually being used by any individual host. It's being used by kind of everyone on the subnet. How many people here work for a company? No. How many people here work for a corporation? All right. You guys know the legal fiction behind a corporation? Many, many people, one person legally that you're dealing with. If anyone leaves that company, that corporation, the corporation is independent of who is there. It's e pluribus unum at its finest. We can do the same thing to IP addresses, you know. You issue layer 4 requests against a remote host. You unicast those over layer 3. So everybody gets together, one of them sends a request from this shared IP. All the responses come back to everybody. As I was saying on the slide, elegance has left the building. This is not an elegant solution, but it is a useful one. Firewall issues. Well, this gets through NAT. NAT translates unicast IPs, and we've got a unicast IP. NAT has no way of knowing that this is actually being transmitted to everybody. Yes, that's multicast through NAT. UDP. With UDP, remote side can just keep sending data. Because the way that state management happens on a firewall with UDP, UDP is stateless, so it just operates on a timeout. If it doesn't get any packets for n number of seconds from the outside world, it gives up. I mean, it closes the state, and no more packets will be accepted. So you just stream UDP packets in. You don't need a response from any of those listeners. All the listeners can just sit there. So in realistic terms, you probably have some out-of-band method of saying, hey, we're all done here. Now, that we're all done here problem is actually one of the core multicast issues, just so you guys know. Yes? Go ahead.
First of all, in order to do that, you need to already be inside the network.
Yes, the idea is that it's not a generic multicast. You don't get to multicast everyone. Oh, he's observing that you have to be inside the network to do this. Absolutely true, 100% true. You can only request a multicast stream onto, you can only guerrilla request a multicast stream, somehow that works, onto your own subnet. You can't just send one out and expect it to reach everywhere. But I still think that it's new and it's useful.
The second question.
Go ahead.
Let's say First, I'm not sure if you're really saving packets here, because you also need to count the arguments you set your issue. The ARP response. And the other thing is, the packet would reach the TCP IP stack of the machine, but the TCP IP stack of the machine would throw it away because it doesn't have its own IP address.
Oh, well, that's why you use promiscuous sniffing. Okay, so he's observing a couple things. First of all, he's observing that your own TCP IP stack inside your kernel isn't going to know what the hell to do with this. It's not to your MAC address, and it's not to your IP address, so why does your kernel care? The answer is your kernel doesn't care. That's why you use libpcap to do something other than destroy some other host. And you had, what was your other observation? It was good. you were talking about ARP packets. You don't actually. Because, well, I'll explain. So the request. So your switch says, "Hey, who has this IP address? Somebody who's listening." I'll explain the method of somebody. Somebody responds, "Oh, I have this IP address, and my hardware address is multicast, or my hardware address is multicast or broadcast." So the idea is that you're actually behaving totally normally. It's just when it hits the switch, it goes to everybody instead of just to one. And then once everybody gets it, everybody parses it. But you know, you've got to deal with some protocol. Is that answer your question? All right. You have some protocols that demand responses. Huh? TCP is, you know, an obvious one. Is it possible to have a responding protocol that operates using a Gorilla multicast system? Yeah, and it works really, really well. This is what you do. So this, you send out somebody sends out a request. Response comes back, hits everybody. Let's say there's five people listening. Five people say, "Oh, hey, there's something I'm supposed to respond to." You know, I'll go ahead and I'll assemble what my response is supposed to be. I'll put it in a queue, and I'll wait a random amount of time before I send my response. If someone else sends the response before me, well, then I don't need to send my response. But if nobody else sends the response before me, well, then I'll send it. This is, you know, this is how Ethernet works. This is how human conversation works. It's also why conference calls between like 15 people don't work so well. And why, you know, it ends up leading to just people being forced to interrupt each other violently, linguistically violently. The idea is it's just like a corporation. You call, somebody picks up you don't know. If nobody picks up, someone else picks up. One of these people is going to get it. One of these people is going to be, it's their turn. One of these people in a random selection is going to be the one who had the lowest delay. And they're the one who responds. And when they respond, everyone else on the subnet sees the response. Nobody else on the subnet makes it. So you can actually, to the outside world, look like you have a normal, nice TCP connection, one host to one host, but it's actually one host on the outside world, many hosts on the inside. That's that. I don't think. Do we have any other situations where one IP stands in for many hosts? Now we really start going after NAT. Now, for all I like to play with NAT, I decided I'd try to go ahead and rewrite it and make a replacement for it because I wanted to see if it was possible. Is there another way, besides, you know, using 10 dots and RFC 1918 and whatnot, is there another way that we can go ahead and not have to worry about our global IP space? And, you know, once again, because if the answer was no, I wouldn't be up here talking about it. So I think the answer is just going to be yes every time I talk about this stuff. On the one hand, can we do this? On the other hand, can we get incoming connections in? The answer is yes. All our hosts behind the gateway can have the external IP. You have a cable modem. Cable modem gives you one IP. You take a host behind the gateway, you give it the cable modem IP. See, it has a different MAC address. In fact, if you have five hosts, they all have different MAC addresses. You eliminate the ARP cache, you integrate the ARP cache with the state table from NAT, so you had, before you had layer 3 state, now you have layer 2 and layer 3 state, and you multiplex off of that. Now check this out. This actually maintains end-to-end integrity through NAT with multiple hosts. I think I'm this IP address. When the packet leaves my firewall, it's the same IP address. When the packet comes back to my firewall, you know, it's my firewall sends it back to me. same IP address. The ports, no problem. Everyone uses random ports. It's not entirely no problem, though. You see, the issue is, in a random selection from a given bit field, so 16 bits, the amount, the odds that you're going to have a collision, two hosts coming up with the same local port number, is actually going to be 1 out of 256. You take the 2 by 16, and you have the power, so it becomes 2 to the 8th, or 256. This is the birthday paradox named because if you take 23 people in a room, you're most likely going to have two people with the same birthday. It's not because every time you add another birthday, that's another chance for another birthday to match for the next guy. So as long as people don't pick the same local port, really, really trivial to have end-to-end packet integrity because everyone has different local ports. Incidentally, just to give credit, this was inspired by this protocol called RSVP. Which I might be screwing up, might be, I don't know, RSIP maybe. Whatever, doesn't matter. If the local ports are different, no problem. You know, our state table doesn't eat easily. If they select the same local port, we have a couple options. First of all, we can, you know, change the local port that we send to the outside world, and we get this new local port response. We just translate back on our way back to our internal host. But then we actually lose end-to-end packet integrity, and that sort of sucks. There are some other alternate strategies which I haven't fully investigated but are just as evil as everything else I work on. You can munge the sequence number to actually somehow reflect which connection on the same local port is which. Because the problem is you get this packet back from the outside world, you need to know which session to attach it to because packets are disconnected except for their shared data between them. This has problems with windows overlapping. Sometimes you don't even need to change the sequence number. You can just use the random sequence numbers that they come up with themselves. And this actually works okay because sequence numbers are 32 bits. So you take the 32 bits and you have that and you still have 2 to the 16. Well, that's 1 out of 65K off of already a 1 out of 256. So, you know, 1 out of 16 million. I'm not too worried, let me put it that way. But you have issues because the sequence number changes with each individual packet. And eventually, if you have two streams that are moving at differential speeds, eventually, you know, one's going to go slow, one's going to go fast, and they're going to collide. And then you're sort of screwed. TCP timestamps are an option. Most hosts don't have the same exact time set. You might be able to use timestamps to get something going. Maybe MTU decrementing. So you go ahead and I barely thought about this. I just, you know, brainstormed what's possible. It might be possible to say, you know, connections from this host, I'm going to assign an MTU of 576. Connections from this host, I'm going to assign an MTU of 575. And so on and so on and so on. And I think this gets reflected. I might be wrong. Oh, okay. Fragmentation is an issue. I'm not dealing with fragmentation yet.
Not about fragmentation. You contacted the server, mm-hmm. and all it had to say was 50 bytes. That's all it has to say.
Do servers reflect the MTU that you send them, or do they not?
If you send an MSS, they will honor that MSS. And that's what you probably want to do.
Okay, MSS would probably work then, but then you couldn't use it for UDP. So, I mean, like I said, I, you know, was random brainstorming. Don't worry about that. We're talking about things that don't have a high likelihood of need. But incoming connectivity. There's a need for incoming connectivity into NATs. And it's actually made a lot easier with the MAT approach. I call it the pizza protocol. Why? Because if you've ever lived in a... Oh, go. We have a question.
If you talk about both hosts behind NAT,
talking to
the same server the other end, that will
destroy the radio. Oh, no. That's... Okay. The question is, if both hosts behind the NAT are talking to the same host, does my solution still work? In fact, my solution is only relevant if both hosts are talking to the same machine. Because that's the only time you can't switch off the IP. The idea is you have two hosts behind your NAT that are talking to the same machine. Well, hopefully selected different local ports. Oh, well, they didn't select different local ports. Well, maybe we can find one of these other magic values to flip off of. Or, you know, maybe we can just send the packets to both and see who likes it. And, you know, not send the disconnect. That actually is not a terrible... No, wait, I think that fails too really badly. Yeah, okay, I did not say that. That's a terrible idea. That causes That actually fails miserably because the values actually get handled as correct. They actually get into the TCP stream. So you actually would get crosstalk between two TCP streams. This is defined as a bad thing. All right. Anyone order a pizza? You get a packet you get a packet to your globally addressable IP. It's shared between five hosts. Ask all five. Anybody hosting a web server? First person to send a response. Well, what you do is you send the request to everybody. Any reset acts you get, which basically say, oh, I'm not hosting that. Any reset acts you get, you just don't forward them. You know, you drop them in the bit bucket. Synac, forward that out. Maybe even, this is stateless. We'll forget the stateless approach. It sucks. The stateful approach is you send the request to everybody on the inside. And this is really easy if everyone has the same MAC address because you send one packet and you set the destination to all apps. And so everybody gets this packet. The IP matches. They all had the same IP, so they all behave as you'd expect. They all respond whether they've got a web server up or not. First one to say they've got a web server up, they're the ones who get the state entry. So you actually allow Synax from your internal to open state entries in your NAT table. Wrap your mind around that. It's amazing what you can do when security is not an issue. So this has been implemented about 98%. I have a bunch of bugs in it. It's another component to that Pakatokaritsu. AllNet, the all-new translation engine. And if you want to read anything else in the name, go right ahead. Incidentally, ScanRand is actually named after Ayn Rand. I just had this image of Ayn Rand's thumbs up. It's stateless. It's like a name of a variable that I'm like, okay, that's priceless. All right. AllNewt actually goes beyond all that stuff in the slides. I left the stuff in the slides for theory, but AllNewt's cool. It translates any local IP address. It doesn't care into a globally routable IP address. And instead of just storing which RFC 1918 IP you picked, which IP source you picked, it stores that. It stores the Ether D host, the destination. So in other words, what hardware address you thought you were talking to as your gateway, and it stores the Ether S host, the source host. What hardware address you're keeping for yourself? All right. If your IP source is equal to your external IP, so if you're matching your cable modem IP, the packets can remain end-to-end whole. They do not need to get molested unless you have that issue we were talking about earlier. If you want to do normal NAT, okay, this is your source. You think you're 10 dot, and you sent to the gateway IP, or you sent to the gateway hardware address. That's one issue. You don't necessarily need to know what IP address somebody thinks you are as the gateway. You just get a packet, and it has some destination that ain't yours. So you forward it off. You remember who they thought you were, because they're probably going to expect a response from you. If you set your IP source to some IP that's globally routable somewhere on the internet, Yahoo's IP or Microsoft's IP, no difference. Just another address. It's just another address you're using locally. It'll translate it. This has applications for some hosting providers, for some situations where you're doing a move of IPs. You can pretty trivially just drop IPs somewhere and they'll route. As long as they can recognize the AllNewt software, the AllNewt system, as their gateway. And you can do that with some gratuitous ARP, which is integrated into AllNewt. Or you can do it with the static mapping. You go to this machine, you statically map their gateway to the AllNewt machine. You can do it with some third machine doing a gratuitous ARP. I don't care. Do what you want. I just route packets. Multiple hosts can share the same IP address. That works with RFC 1918. That works with external. That works with global. You can have five Yahoos on your network. Woohoo! Just what I always wanted. It depends on the MAC, because what you're doing is you're splitting on the MAC address. Now, the MAC address can actually be the same. You can have one machine that's proxy ARPing for a bunch of IPs. But then you look at that. The IPs are different. So you can switch, proxy ARP machine will multiplex on that. So it's really flexible. And this will hopefully be out by DEF CON. How many miles away? So, we get to the last of the official things that are in your slides. This is probably the most demented thing that I worked on. And that, I'm not saying that lightly. NATs are really, really bad when it comes to, I want to set up, I have two NATs. NATs trust you to make outgoing connections, right? Well, I have two guys behind NATs, and they want to make outgoing connections to each other. Well, one hits one firewall, one hits one firewall, then you get the NAT. They try to hit the other person's firewall. Well, now it's an incoming session. NAT's not set up to do incoming well. That's why we had all the, you know, alternative NAT situation built up. But in this situation, we don't have the ability to, you know, magically replace the firewall or the NAT engine with, you know, some cracked out thing I talked about at Black Hat. No, we actually have to use a PIX, or we actually have to use those really, really beautiful Linksys devices. Got two Linksys. How do I set up a TCP connection between them? Can you do it? Yes. Yes, you can, but oh my God, it's ugly. oh, Jesus. You convince each firewall that the other one picked it up, that the other one accepted the connection. And you have to use a connection broker, but it's just for the handshake. It's not like what I was talking about last year. One of the things talked about in hack proofing is you go ahead and you, well, one guy SSHs into a guy in the middle. The other guy SSHs into the guy in the middle. And they set up a cryptographically end-to-end secure connection. And, you know, it's really cool and it's really useful. But it's really expensive in terms of bandwidth. And you had to put a server somewhere. It's the real-world equivalent of the Jordan-Israeli phone call scam. Check this out. Probably shouldn't talk about this. Whatever. So there was a period of time in history where it was illegal to make a phone call from Jordan to Israel and vice versa. So some enterprising people had the great idea. They'd set up a bunch of apartment complexes in the United States. They'd get as many lines into them as possible and have people from Jordan call the United States. They'd have people from Israel call the United States. And at that apartment complex, you take the phones and you link them together, and there you go. You've got a call between Jordan and Israel. But you had to rent the apartments, you had to rent the phone equipment, you had to pay the phone bills, and they got caught for two reasons. One, they did some great data mining and found, you know, gee, there's these, all these calls that seem to be happening at the same time. That's really suspicious. The other thing was they just didn't actually pay for anything. Every time the leases were due, they left and got another one. Good job, guys. So, the SSH solution works. It works for small loads. It doesn't work for example, a P2P network. It just takes too much bandwidth. It's the internet's job to get connections from one host to another. It's not some host that you set up magically. The internet should find the fastest route. It shouldn't be you have to set up, dear God, the only route. That shouldn't be needed. You basically play layers against each other. And we can skip this explanation. So, yeah, Bill Gates and Larry Note, whatever. Alice and Bob, both behind NATing firewalls. The firewalls authorize all the outgoing sessions, and they block all incoming sessions. They block with state. Now, this is really important. There was a period in history where you had stateless firewalls. They thought, hey, we can block all connections by just blocking all SYNs that come from the outside world into our firewall. That's great. I send a SYN ACK. It's the equivalent of calling up, we'll use Bill Gates. Call up Bill Gates' secretary. Oh yeah, Bill was just talking to me. Let me say this to him. Bill Gates' secretary is like, oh, you said you were talking to him. You said he called you. So I'll let you talk to him. And so it was really, really easy to set up connections using acknowledgments instead of using, you know, a generic SYN, which would get blocked. So firewalls, they only accept fully validated responses to outgoing messages. Once you call someone on a telephone, even if it's a telephone that the outside world can't call, you don't just want to be able to speak. You'd be really antisocial. You call somebody, even from a restricted phone, you get to hear their responses for that session only. They don't get the right to call you in the future. And that's managed in TCP by forcing all ports to match and forcing sequence numbers to match. It is, you got total outgoing trust, zero incoming trust. Bill Gates can call whoever the hell he wants. I can't call him. God, life is unfair. So here's the attempt. Let's look at it really slowly. First of all, remember what we were talking about layers, about how you've got all these hosts, you've got all these differential requirements, and you've got even redundancies, but that's not so much here. When Alice wants to talk to Bob, it doesn't just magically happen. If you slow time down, and it goes pretty fast normally, First of all, Alice can't directly route to Bob because Bob's behind the NATing firewall. The closest address that Alice has to Bob is, in fact, Bob's firewall. Look at the packet. Sent over layer 2 to next closest host, Alice's firewall. Alice's firewall gets this packet, says, oh, that's great. Now, here's a 10 dot. If I send it out, I'm not getting the response. No one is. Or, you know, someone does some BGP games, and maybe someone does. But, so the packet goes out, or the packet hits Alice's firewall, and it opens an entry in a state table, opens a really small hole in the rule set, effectively, for this firewall, that if any packet happens to come specifically matching what this response is supposed to be, it says, aha, this is part of this session. This, you know, one of my guys called out, and here's the person speaking back. So, SYN hits Alice's firewall. It's given a global IP and entry in a state table. The state table entry basically says, a connection has been attempted. SYN travels across the internet, bounce, 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 about 10 or 15 hosts or whatever, hits Bob's firewall. Bob's firewall doesn't want anything to do with Alice. Bob's firewall says, screw off, sends a reset ACK, I'm not listening. The reset ACK hits Alice's firewall. Alice's firewall had this state entry, and the reset ACK matches it just fine. And the state entry gets torn down. No more opening, no more hole. And, you know, the screw off and die message gets forwarded off to Alice. And, you know, this happens to Bob if Bob tries to connect to Alice. Now, what's good? Good is we had an entry in the firewall state table. It was waiting for a reply. What's bad is the reply was die. I hate you. I don't want to talk to you. Can we get the good, you know, let's talk, without the bad, go away? The answer is yes. Yes, we can. You see, Alice's firewall is a hell of a lot closer on the network than Bob's firewall. We do have a way of restricting how far a packet will travel. It's called the TTL. So yeah, you set your TTL entry to about 4. What this does is, the packet gets to Alice's firewall, open state entry, hits the net, hops about 2 or 3 times and dies. No reset ACK. There's an ICMP error, but that's not a reset ACK. Alice's firewall sitting here has an opening. Bob does the same thing. Bob's firewall is sitting there. Bob has an opening. They both have holes in their firewall open for each other. Now, granted, they're really specific holes. They have all these requirements for sequence numbers and local ports and whatnot, but they both have holes for each other. And now... and now, the other shoe drops. Now you add the connection broker. Handshake only. Its job is to send that SYN ACK that neither of them can send to each other. Alice and Bob conspire with the connection broker to have it send the SYN ACKs that neither one of them can. Alice and Bob can figure out through a really, really ugly process exactly what port number and exactly what sequence number the firewall wants. And, you know, this does actually involve setting up multiple connections and spraying packets and throwing shit into the IP ID and whatnot. It's messy. It's a horrific mess. But at the end result is you can get a TCP session between 2 NATed hosts. It works. 3-way handshake. Yeah, you need to discover a whole bunch of stuff. It's a pain. Local ports. The local ports issue is hard. Different firewalls behave different ways. Some firewalls try to match your local port that you sent out. Remember, it only matters what local port the response comes back to. It doesn't matter what the local port is on the internet. It just matters what your firewall sends to you. So if your firewall does a translation to your own personal local port, you don't know or care, theoretically, what local port your firewall sent out. So some firewalls will try to match yours and will only do the switching mechanism if there's a collision in process. Some increment from a fixed counter, and you can actually use those firewalls to see how many sessions are going on behind them. Some just go random. I think OpenBSD does. And, you know, hey, there's a great channel for cryptography in the middle of your network. Your firewall can be emitting as much data as you want because there's no need to worry. You need to discover what strategy is being used. So you have this big old sequence. Alice and Bob send a couple SYNs to this connection broker. They actually try to talk to him. And they say, you know, I sent this information. It's messy. I'm not going to go into it now because it would take like 15 minutes and I'd probably screw something up. But the end result is, with a large number of packets and a large number of communication, eventually there achieves convergence. There's a convergence between what ports are expected at Alice's firewall and what ports are expected at Bob's firewall. You need to achieve TCP convergence, because if you don't, those two socket pairs will not be seen as the same socket. So I'm serious. This is it's ugly and a pain and horrible. Okay. So I can't come to Black Hat and not describe at least some attack. There is an interesting attack you can do here. Alice can forge connections from arbitrary IPs by cooperating with Charlie. Alice can make it look like she's getting a certain stream of information from Yahoo, or she's getting a certain stream of information from Microsoft, and the IDS has no way to know. So, Alice makes a request to Charlie. Alice makes a request to Yahoo. Is TTL limited? Alice informs Charlie, this guy in the middle, whatnot, of the exact traits that the firewall is expecting from the response. Charlie replies, as if he was Yahoo, begins a TCP stream of whatever data he wants to send to Alice. On the network, it's all spoofed. So Charlie already had the ability to do IP spoofs. Charlie IP spoofs Yahoo. Alice sends acknowledgments to this fake stream from Charlie. Alice acknowledges it. It's all nice and dandy. But it all has lowered TTL, so it never actually reaches Yahoo. Yahoo has no involvement, never gets any packets, but Charlie gets to talk to Alice as if he was Yahoo. End result being, if you have somebody in the middle who has rule sets that are based off of what IPs you're talking to, or is just looking, is just observing, all this outgoing world traffic to the inside looks legitimate, when in fact it's coming from a completely unknown party. It's not completely unknown. There are some really obvious signs. There's mysterious traffic from Alice to Charlie. There's the fact that TTLs are limited. So if you actually know what you're looking for, it's really obvious that this scam's in progress. But if you don't know what you're looking for, your logs say ironclad. This host sent this data, and I know the stream existed because Alice sent a bunch of responses to it. Now, did you have a question, Ray?
Yeah, I can actually wait till you're done
here. All right. What time? How much time do I have left, by the way?
25 minutes.
Oh, okay.
All right. We're doing just fine then. Now, I got a conclusion here, but there is one interesting more thing that I realized in the last few days. And actually, I'm bringing this up because I'm interested in critiques. You remember when I was talking about using the random delays that multiple hosts could serve the same connection? So in other words, I'm supposed to reply to this, but I'll wait a random amount of time to see if someone else replies first. Now, there's a really interesting thing that is possible because LibRadiate just came out. And that's using this process to let every single wireless card repeat the signal, be an extender. And the algorithm I've come up with is basically, if you detect a host unable to reach its destination, if you detect that, you copy the packet with a random delay. Now, the reason you use the random delay is if there's another one of you guys who's going to copy the packet if they see it not getting responded to, it'll do it first, and then you won't do it. Or if the person gets in range of the base station. The base station has no random delay. So the base station will reply first, and these extenders won't do it. The end result, hopefully, should be as a wireless cloud extends, so should its range. You should never have the situation where the guy next to you has Ethernet, has wireless connectivity, and you don't. Because the guy next to you has it. You should be able to bounce off of him. So it adds latency. This stuff's been talked about for cell phones. Never going to work for cell phones. Too much battery requirements for cells, and not even to mention, latency actually matters for voice. It doesn't matter that much for data. We have these nice things called sliding windows to handle that. So, that's pretty much what I'm working on, what I'm thinking about, what I've been playing with. I will have code out. It should be out now. I'm terribly sorry. But the Paketo Kairetsu will be out soon enough. Now, going to open the floor up for questions, but I got one kind of quirky little thing. First two questions to impress me, I'm going to give you a free copy of the book. I want to be impressed here. Critiques, impressed, whatever. I'll be sure to repeat the questions, and there is actually a quick announcement to everybody. Hacker Court is going to be in Palace 3, not Palace 1. And I talked to a few people who are involved with Hacker Court. they're pretty much running a real hacker trial with all the people who would genuinely be in one. So, yeah, that should be interesting. So, that being said, ask me questions. If you blow me away, you're getting the book. So, let's begin. You. Yeah. Actually, can you hang on 1 second? Let me see if these are really complicated questions. Hang on 1 second.
I'm sorry, I've got one more announcement, and then I can let him go, let you go as long as you'd like.
Sweet.
Yes.
You've seen these little pink. I have one in my pocket. You've seen these pink sheets that we have taped up. Oh, right there. Keith's holding one. On it are the IP address and MAC addresses of our feedback system and our gateway router. A lot of people are ARP spoofing stuff. So make static entries to these MAC addresses to... That should solve most of your problems. And also, there's IP address to our feedback server. It's up and running. Make sure you check the SSL certificate fingerprint that's also printed on there. You just, you know, want to be fair about these things. And also, your username and password to log in to the feedback system is printed on your receipt that came with your badge. So if you have any questions about how to log in, it's the username and password is printed on there. Okay. That said, I want to pass it back.
All right. God damn it. All right, we're going to do things actually a little differently here. If you got questions, come up, because people here have good questions, and I don't want to mangle them by repeating them. So if you can come up, Mike, if you got a question, like, I'm going to give a mic. Yeah, 1 sec. Yes, I know. I'm asking you to move. I'm very sorry. Go ahead. Hit me.
Okay, what I was wondering is if you put a multicast MAC address into one of these crappy Linksys routers and somebody tries to reply to what you've told it is a multicast mask, is that going to piss off the internet in general?
The internet doesn't know.
When they try to reply back to
the internet is replying to, in fact, the same globally addressable IP that it'd be doing for unicast stuff. The multicast only exists on your LAN. It only exists on layer 2 on your LAN. On layer 3, it's a nice unicast machine. It's, you know, every packet looks like there's just one participant. So, you know what? I lose a lot of the benefits of multicast, but I gain the fact that you can deploy it today and not never. So that's, you don't have to worry about pissing anyone off.
Yeah, okay.
All
right. Even if you put it on the external?
I'm talking to the mic.
Even if you put it on the external interface of the router? That's what I was wondering about.
He's asking if you put it on the external interface of your router, if you have your source be all Fs. First of all, that would only be an issue on systems that use Ethernet over long range, so cable and cable non-PPPoE. Well, even PPPoE will do it. I haven't thought of what would happen, to be honest. There are probably a few DSLAMs and a few cable head ends that would start to broadcast things to everyone. It will be fun to investigate.
Cool.
All right, Mr. Schiffman.
Okay, I have a comment and a question. I think when you talked about multicast addresses, what do they look like on the wire? And I think somebody here might be able to correct me, but if it's the low order, first byte's odd, I think that's what it is. First, low order bit, right. Well, that's IP. We're talking Ethernet.
You take 28 bits of the IP and you put that, I don't know what the prefix is, but after the prefix, the last 28 bits of a multicast MAC match the multicast IP or something like that.
I think that what Ryan said over there,
all right.
It's actually pretty fundamental.
I knew this off the top of my head last week. I'm just blanking on it now. But it's not hard to create a multicast MAC address. It's quite trivial. A cheap switch will just broadcast it because that's generically correct behavior. Some expensive Cisco switches will, if you have the IGMP snooping option enabled, will attempt to send them only to those who are listening.
Some might listen, depending on the address, too. The other question I had was, you were talking about these doomed SYN packets that are going out to contrived TTLs expiring out on the internet.
Uh-huh.
You're getting your TTL time expired in transit mesh. It's sent back to your source host.
Yep.
In that message, you're going to get your IP header and 8 bytes of the payload
uh-huh.
of the offending, in this case, TCP packet. And that 8 bytes, you're going to have your source and destination ports.
No. Firewalls could. Firewalls could use this to shut down the state.
That was my point. And have you tested that across?
No. Okay, no firewall does.
Okay.
Because nobody ever abuses it for this purpose.
Okay. There's a note to all you vendors out there.
So start
processing ICMP error messages for TCP-based data.
Oh, check this out. So a bunch of firewalls will just like not send any reply. They won't even send the reset ACK. Like a lot of major companies just like won't do it. Because they're thinking, we look invisible. Well, I think your invisibility was ruined by that one port you're sending a SYNAC for, and all those ports you don't send reset acts off of? Well, great. I didn't need to lower my TTL because a message went out, and no reply came back. So someone else can come on in and send the reply for it. You don't actually need to mess around.
TTL games are fun, actually.
Yes. And you also can do interesting things. The two other approaches. First of all, yeah, you can source route through the connection broker if source routing works on both sides. It's less fun, but it works better. And the best approach involves just using UDP like all the game guys do. You just match ports and time it so both requests hit the firewalls before the request hits the other side, and then both requests are perceived as responses from the other side.
Stateless, yeah. And my last comment's good talk.
Thank you.
Good content. And that RAND, what was it, the TCP scanning stuff,
mm-hmm.
you're gonna release that?
Yes. I will even give you the source immediately after the talk.
Port it to 1.1.
First off, whatever you smoke for lunch, I'd like to have some. The real question here is regarding your Gorilla multicasting. You indicated that there's this arbitrary holdback where people are waiting to see if somebody else responds.
Uh-huh.
It's destined for a unicast MAC address, but it's sourced from a multicast or broadcast, whatever MAC address. How are other people on a switch network going to know that someone's already responded?
How does this work? I think you send two broadcasts.
So you send something, the way I would structure it would be, I send the packet mm-hmm. to my gateway with its MAC address, and then I follow it immediately with a broadcast message that says, hey, I sent it, everybody else, shut up.
You can do that, but I think gateways will accept the packet from broadcast.
Well, it's not the gateway accepting the packet, it's everyone else in the network understanding that the packet's been sent.
No. What I'm saying, You know, that you might be right. I think you're actually correct, because if you send to a broadcast, the gateway doesn't know it's supposed to gateway the packet.
Right.
So you're right. I think you do actually need to send an additional metadata packet,
okay.
Which is less elegant.
Right.
But you get a book for that.
two questions, actually. The first, all your tricks to find out the ports are correct, the sequence numbers are correct. Won't they, on certain levels, trigger a SYN attack and block you?
Seriously, if you've got countermeasures in place that deal with anything weird happening, this is about as weird as it gets, and that's quite intentional. But if there are
not in terms of weird, and certainly not in terms of blocking that, because if you look at the rule base, that's supposed to work. Each party is allowed to initiate connections outside, and so.
The rules got thrown in the toilet once people realized that the internet's supposed to be secure and you shouldn't actually be able to reach everybody.
No, I'm talking about the firewall rules. Both ends, the firewall was configured to allow the
outgoing connections.
Outgoing connection.
Okay.
And this is as far as both ends are considered. This is an outgoing connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as far as rule base is concerned, you're not doing anything malicious here.
Yeah. I'm just trying to achieve.
I know I'm breaking.
No. This is important. From a purely theoretical standpoint, both firewalls are trusting their own users to make outgoing connections. It's a quirk of the way that they're issuing that trust that causes a failure when the other guy also trusts their own side. It's like Bill Gates and Larry Ellison want to talk to each other. Bill Gates can't call Larry because his secretary's in the way. Larry Ellison can't call Bill because Bill's secretary's in the way. These are both people who are powerful enough to get whatever they want from their secretaries, believe me, but because of the way they've arranged their networking and because their secretaries are dumb, they can't negotiate.
Our offer also set up so that people on the inside can only talk to specific individuals on the outside.
Oh, now that's true. One big problem is what if you can't route to the connection broker? In that case, you might be quite screwed.
But
if you can just if you have instant messaging, if you have like email will work because email has turned into a low latency system. Like literally, there's this quote in the intelligence world: it's you can always send a bit. We only need to send about 32 to 64 per packet, or per exchange. So I don't think that's too much of a problem.
The second question is something that nobody implements.
Okay.
Is actually written there in the RFC, and it's called simultaneous SYN, and it immediately solves your problem.
Things that are theoretical very often would solve my problem. Like I said, I don't think the structure of the internet is not going to change. It's quite fixed. There's too many machines to upgrade to IPv6. There's too many machines to upgrade all over the place. The only hope, in my mind, is to find ways of, like, at certain endpoints, doing upgrades. Or at least upgrading capabilities or using what's already there.
No, but theoretically,
if SimulSyn was deployed, yeah, this wouldn't be a problem.
Your problem is the firewalls, not the TCP/IP stack, who actually support that. But I think
the firewalls are never going to support SimulSyn.
I know.
They're never going to support anything new. Their job is to decrease functionality, not increase.
No, actually,
that's fine.
I'll deal. Seriously, their job is to support what is being used and nothing more than that.
Yeah, well, use a little more. All right. Next question.
What I'm wondering is the message broker that you introduced to guess the port numbers and the sequence numbers and everything. How is that different from anyone trying to spoof my connection today?
A big important thing is that I'm conspiring with a connection broker, and so is the other guy, so we have a channel between each other.
But you have two different...
I'm opening a hole for a very specific specific host. I mean, at the end of the day, that's the big deal. The hole that I'm opening, it's temporary. It's open for what's the timeout on the state table? 2 minutes. So the hole's open for 2 minutes. It requires both of us to come to this connection broker at the exact same time. It requires a decent amount of work, basically both endpoints insisting, using all their influence and all their ability to insist that this connection open up. This is really different from a random schmuck coming in at a random time saying, hey, can I talk to this guy who, by the way, has a private IP and I can't even specify who he is.
I would say it's more difficult because you have two connections to try and spoof instead of one.
I think that's also true.
So you're not adding anything with your scheme.
Wait.
It's just more difficult. You have two connections to spoof. One at the first firewall, one at the second firewall. If I'm trying to spoof a normal connection, I only have to spoof one.
Wait. How do you get the context? It's an issue of context. It's like you have the sequence number to match and the local port to match.
Right.
That's 2 to the 32 plus 2, times 2 to the 16. You got 2 to 48 to guess.
Yeah.
But now that's impossible.
But in two ways, Ellis and Bob's firewall. If I'm trying to spoof you, today's world, without your new scheme, I only have to spoof one firewall. In your scheme, you have to spoof two. I don't care that you have a connection to your broker, because since things are random, the port number is random.
But by using the... Okay. So by using the broker lets both sides figure out what they're supposed to spoof and can do it in, like, 9 packets. Now, if you've got a unidirectional spoof that's got 9 packets... Like, you don't just deserve the book. You deserve, like, Singer's Press. Because 9-packet accurate spoofing out of a 2 to the 48 range, okay, without knowing how broken the operating system is. Yeah, it's... Yours is not...
Your first scene has to not reach the destination. And you can't use the operating system in TCP/IP stack. You have to assume that you control both...
Yes, and in fact, you do. The idea is... You are sending specially constructed... Okay, so you send a specially constructed SYN to the connection broker that's supposed to have fixed values. Connection broker compares what it actually got, you know, what the firewall sent to the broker, to what Alice sent to Alice's firewall, and then assumes if Alice tries to send something to Bob's firewall, a similar transformation is going to take place. So if it's a random sequencer, if it's a incrementer, so you actually have to use two or three, or if it's a attempt to match, whatever happens when Alice attempts to create this connection to the connection broker will most likely also happen when Alice tries to make this connection to Bob's firewall. And I mean, the way where I'm coming from is just my system gives you a fighting chance of coming across those numbers that you need to determine how to get the connection. If you don't have that process, you're screwed.
But even if the file was using a random sequence number, random port numbers, still in nine packets, you're able to get the right answer?
If they're using random sequence numbers, it's pretty much impossible.
Okay.
I think there's a way of doing it if only one side is using randomness.
So you're telling me there's firewalls that don't do random sequence numbers?
No. Most don't. Second of all, PIX does, but has an option to...
No, I'm talking about serious firewalls.
Touché.
I can answer that.
You
will not touch the communication if it can avoid that, because the firewalls, serious firewalls, are in a race to be high score.
Yes. And coming up with random data, you use a pseudo-random. But no, I mean, he's right. Most firewalls don't change it. And, you know, this is all really theoretical. If you really want to do this, you do it over UDP, because UDP has no sequence numbers and the port range is small. And in fact, the port range is really never changed because a lot of applications care about what the local port was. So at the end of the day, TCP splicing is really fun and really cool to laugh at, but use UDP. Match your UDP ports. Like, match your local port, match your destination port, send both packets at the same time, use like some, you know, SNTP library to sync your two machines, send both requests out at the same time, both responses will be perceived as responses to the other. Or both requests will be received as responses. I mean, if you just look at it on the timeline, they are both responses, because, you know, they happen to have the same information, just flipped. That's the way to do it. The reason why this doesn't always work, first of all, a lot of firewalls only allow DNS outgoing. You can figure out my next sentence. You can do that over DNS if you have that kind of firewall. But then your IDS is going to say, those don't look like DNS packets. So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting hack. At the end of the day, you're not going to do TCP over the wire. Now, you might, however, take your TCP stack on your machine, listen to it, and encapsulate its packets inside a UDP. Or even just like flip the bits and move stuff around so that, you know, you reconstruct and redeliver to your TCP stack. All of this is like libpcap, libnet stuff where you're doing as much as possible to avoid the participation of your kernel, because your kernel is not built to do this, nor should it be. Do we have any other questions? Anyone at all? All right, then. I want to express my thanks to every single one of you. Seriously, thanks for coming. I do have some things. I have guide to the SSH stuff from last year and these nice little postcards. And I will actually be outside signing books. So if you want one, go ahead. And, it's downstairs? I'll be downstairs.